My name is Michael McCusker. As you are probably aware, today the war in Iraq is declared officially over. Mission accomplished, right? But the war in Afghanistan continues inexorably on. The same troops removed from Iraq are now slated for Afghanistan, and for them, the war goes on forever. At least, perhaps, Iraqis are not going to be killed as many as were anyway, the 100,000 that apparently have been dead in the last 9 years to America's 4,000. But we'll see. The war continues. Afghanistan, Iraq, we are at war. Just putting the, taking the troops out of one place and putting them in another doesn't stop the war. Well, I'd like to read a few things this morning, see if I can get them all stuffed into this less than half hour. The first one is from Rolling Stone. It's November 24th, 2011 issue by Matt Tabai. How I Stopped Worrying and Learned to Love the Protests. If anyone remembers Dr. Strangelove. I have a confession to make at first. I misunderstood Occupy Wall Street. For the first few times I went down to Zuccotti Park, I came away with mixed feelings. I loved the energy and was amazed by the obvious organic appeal of the movement, the way it was growing on its own. But my initial impression was that it would not be taken very seriously by the Citibanks and Goldman Sachs of the world. You could put 50,000 angry protesters on Wall Street, 100,000 even, and Lloyd Blankfein is probably not going to break a sweat. He knows he's not going to wake up tomorrow and see Cornel West or Richard Trumka running the Federal Reserve. He knows modern finance is a giant mechanical parasite that only an expert surgeon can remove. Yell and scream all you want, but he and his fellow financial Frankensteins are the only ones who know how to turn the machine off. That's what I was thinking during the first few weeks of the protests. But I'm beginning to see another angle. Occupy Wall Street was always about something much bigger than a movement against big banks and modern finance. It's about providing a forum for people to show how tired they are, not just of Wall Street, but everything. This is a visceral, impassioned, deep-seated rejection of the entire direction of our society, a refusal to take even one more step forward into the shallow commercial abyss of phoniness, short-term calculation, withered idealism, and intellectual bankruptcy that American mass society has become. If there is such a thing as going on strike from one's own culture, this is it. And by being so broad in scope and so elemental in its motivation, it's flown over the heads of many on both the right and the left. The right-wing media wasted no time in cannon-blasting the movement with its usual idiotic clichés, casting Occupy Wall Street as a bunch of dirty hippies who should get a job and stop chewing up Mike Bloomberg's police overtime budget with their urban sleepovers. Just like they did a half century ago, when the debate over the Vietnam War somehow stopped being about why we were brutally murdering millions of innocent Indochinese civilians, and instead became a referendum on bralessness and long hair and flower child rhetoric, the depraved flacks of the right-wing media have breezily blown off a generation of fraud and corruption and market-perverting bailouts, making the whole debate about the protesters themselves, their hygiene, their envy, and that's in quotes, of the rich, their hypocrisy, which is also a quote. The protesters, chirped Supreme Reichskank Ann Coulter, needed three things: showers, jobs, and a point. Her colleague, Charles Krauthammer, went so far as to label the protesters hypocrites for having iPhones. Occupation Wall Street, he said, is Starbucks-sipping, Levi's-clad, iPhone-clutching protesters denouncing corporate America even as they weep for Steve Jobs, corporate titans, billionaire eight times over. Apparently, because Goldman and Citibank are corporations, no protester can ever consume a corporate product. not jeans, not cell phones, and definitely not coffee, if he also wants to complain about tax money going to pay off some billionaire banker's bets against his own crappy mortgages. Meanwhile, on the other side of the political spectrum, there were scads of progressive pundits like me who wrung our hands with worry that Occupation Wall Street was playing right into the hands of idiots like Krauthammer. Don't give them any ammunition, we counseled. Stay on message. Be specific. We were all playing the Rorschach test game with Occupy Wall Street, trying to squint at it and see what we wanted to see in the movement. Viewed through the prism of our desire to make near-term, within-the-system changes, it was hard to see how skirmishing with cops in New York would help foreclosed-upon middle-class families in Jacksonville and San Diego. What both sides missed is that Occupation Wall Street is tired of all this. They don't care what we think they're about or should be about. They just want something different. We are all born wanting the freedom to imagine a better and more beautiful future. But modern America has become a place so drearily confining and predictable that it chokes the life out of that built-in desire. Everything from our pop culture to our economy to our politics feels oppressive and unresponsive. We see 10 million commercials a day, and every day is the same life-killing chase for money, money, and more money. The only thing that changes from minute to minute is that every tick of the clock brings with it another space-age vendor dreaming up some new way to sell you something or reach into your pocket. The relentless sameness of the two-party political system is beginning to feel like a Jacob's Ladder nightmare with no end. We are entering another turn on the four-year merry-go-round, and the thought of having to try to get excited about yet another minor quadrennial shift in the direction of one or the other pole of alienated corporate full of damnness is enough to make anyone want to smash his own hand flat with a hammer. If you think of it this way, Occupy Wall Street takes on another meaning. There's no better symbol of the gloom and psychological repression of modern America than the banking system, a huge, heartless machine that attaches itself to you at an early age and from which there is no escape. You fail to receive a few past due notices about a $19 payment you missed on that television you bought at Circuit City, and next thing you know, a collector has filed a judgment against you for $3,000 in fees and interest. Or maybe you wake up one morning and your car is gone, legally repossessed by Vulture Incorporated, the debt-buying firm that bought your loan on the internet from Chase for 2 cents on the dollar. This is why people hate Wall Street. They hate it because the banks have made life for ordinary people a vicious tightrope act. You slip anywhere along the way, it's 10,000 feet down into a vat of razor blades that you can never climb out of. That, to me, is what Occupy Wall Street is addressing. People don't know exactly what they want, but as one friend of mine put it, they know one thing. We want something different, a different life with different values, or at least a chance at different values. There was a lot of snickering in media circles, even by me, when I heard the protesters talking about how Liberty Square was offering a model for a new society with free food and health care and so on. Obviously, a bunch of kids taking donations and giving away free food is not a long-term model for a new economic system. But now I get it. People want to go someplace for at least 5 minutes where no one is trying to bleed you or sell you something. It may not be a real model for anything, but it's at least a place where people are free to dream of some other way for human beings to get along, beyond auctioned democracy, and that's in quotes, tyrannical commerce, and the bottom line. We're a nation that was built on 1,000 different utopian ideas, from the Shakers to the Mormons to New Harmony, Indiana. It was possible once for communities to experiment with everything from free love to an end to private property. But nowadays, even the palest federalism is swiftly crushed. If your state tries to place tariffs on companies doing business with some notorious human rights violator state, like Massachusetts did when it sought to bar state contracts to firms doing business with Myanmar, the decision will be overturned by some distant global bureaucracy like the World Trade Organization. Even if 40 million Californians vote tomorrow to allow themselves to smoke a joint, the federal government will never permit it. And the economy is running almost entirely by an unaccountable oligarchy in Lower Manhattan that absolutely will not sanction any innovations in banking or debt forgiveness or anything else that might lessen its predatory influence. And here's one more thing I was wrong about. I originally was very uncomfortable with the way the protesters were focusing on the New York Police Department as symbols of the system. After all, I thought, these are just working-class guys from the Bronx and Staten Island who have never seen the inside of a Wall Street investment firm, much less had anything to do with the corruption of our financial system. But I was wrong. The police in their own way are symbols of the problem. All over the country, thousands of armed cops have been deployed to stand around and surveil and even assault the polite crowds of Occupy protesters. This deployment of law enforcement resources already dwarfs the amount of money and manpower that the government committed, and that's a quote, to fighting crime and corruption during the financial crisis. One Occupy Wall Street protester steps in the wrong place, and she immediately has police roping her off like wayward cattle. But in the skyscrapers above the protests, anything goes. This is a profound statement about who law enforcement works for in this country. What happened on Wall Street over the past decade was an unparalleled crime wave. Yet at most, maybe 1,500 federal agents were policing that beat, and that little group of financial cops barely made any cases at all. Yet when thousands of ordinary people hit the streets with the express purpose of obeying the law and demonstrating their patriotism through peaceful protests, the police response is immediate and massive. There have already been hundreds of arrests, which is hundreds more than we ever saw during the years when Wall Street bankers were stealing billions of dollars from retirees and mutual fund holders and carpenters unions through the mass sales of fraudulent mortgage-backed securities. It's not that the cops outside the protests are doing wrong per se by patrolling the parks and sidewalks. It's that they should be somewhere else. They should be heading up into those skyscrapers and going through the file cabinets to figure out who stole what and from whom. They should be helping people get their money back. Instead, they're out on the street helping the black fiends, or black fiends, however you want to pronounce his name, of the world avoid having to answer to the people they ripped off. People want out of this fiendy system, rigged to inexorably circumvent every hope we have for a more balanced world. They want major changes. I think I understand now that this is what the Occupy movement is all about. It's about dropping out, if only for a moment, and trying something new, the same way that the civil rights movement of the 1960s strived to create a beloved community free of racial segregation. Eventually, the Occupy movement will need to be specific about how it wants to change the world. But for right now, it just needs to grow. And if it wants to sleep on the streets for a while and not structure itself into a traditional campaign of grassroots organizing, it should. It doesn't need to tell the world what it wants. It is succeeding for now just by being something different. And that was Matt Tabai, How I Stopped Worrying and Learned to Love the Protests. And now I'd like to read something. I call it Occupy Bastille. It was written by a sophomore at Sunset High School in Beaverton, Grant Robertson, and my friend Joanne Halverson got it on the net and gave it to me. In the late 18th century, the French were in deep financial debt because they were funding the American Revolution as well as fighting their own wars with Great Britain. To pay for the cost of these wars, the Third Estate, or 99% of the French population, was hit hard by unfair taxation systems that allowed the king, members of the Catholic Church, and the nobles, the richest landowners in the country, to pay virtually no taxes at all. After many years living under this inequitable taxing structure, many citizens got fed up and pushed for change. Protests erupted in cities and towns all over France, criticizing the government, requesting modifications in the tax regime, and demanding reductions to the outrageous price of basic food items such as bread. They protested for months, starting out rowdy and getting progressively more violent. As tensions grew, the king convened the Estates General, which included the nobles, the clergy, and 200 of the most prosperous, intelligent members of the Third Estate to represent the common people. They were to propose adjustments to the taxation system in France. After meeting once, they came to the conclusion that only the clergy, the nobles, and themselves would vote, leaving the king out of the equation. The king felt slighted about being excluded and was believed to have locked the doors where the Estates General would meet in the morning. This outraged the 200, and they decided to meet instead in a nearby tennis court, where later that day they took the tennis court oath, vowing to stand their ground until a new constitution for France was written. The defiance was displayed by these individuals sparked a flame in the 99%, and the once separate dissenters came together, forming massive violent protests. Houses and bakeries were robbed. Policemen were killed, their heads carried high on pikes. Finally, citizens took over the Bastille, a large prison and storehouse for gunpowder, killing every guard inside and burning it to the ground. Events leading up to the French Revolution parallel the social and economic concerns we are facing in our country today. In modern America, as in historic France, an unequal tax system in which the middle class pays more effective taxes than the rich has created a barrier of wealth between the rich and the poor. In part because of this system, middle class citizens today feel little hope of reaching the desired upper income tier, much like the Third Estate felt going into the French Revolution. Today, America also finds itself in a deep pit of debt caused in large part by the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Even more alarming, the public debt in France in 1791 was $2,028 per person in 2011 dollars, but in the United States today, it is a whopping $48,000 per person. Right now, the Occupy movement is growing. People leave their homes every day to participate in protests in cities and towns across America, criticizing a dysfunctional government and corporate greed. How long might it be until the growing mass of protesters become tired of sitting in parks day after day being ignored? Is our generation going to experience a new American revolution? The answer lies just beneath the surface, but only in time will it emerge. And that was by Grant Robertson, who is a sophomore at Sunset High School in Beaverton. And I sort of slapped the title on it, Occupy Bastille. Now, for the last thing I'm going to read, and I'm going to read as much of it as I can, the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. December 10th, 2011, is the 63rd anniversary of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was last Saturday. And it was spearheaded by Eleanor Roosevelt in 1948. The Declaration is more an aspiration of what we might or ought to be rather than the reality of what we are. Yet because we aspire and envisage, its reality is possible simply because we are able to perceive what we must eventually develop into if we are to alleviate the horrors we create for ourselves on our home planet. Every reference to the male gender in the Declaration as encompassing humanity will also be followed by her. And that was my little lead into, so that might be my opinion only in the entire cosmos. The United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 1. All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act toward one another in a spirit of brotherhood. Article 2. Everyone is entitled to all the rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration without distinction of any kind, such as race, color, sex, language, religion, political or other opinion, national or social origin, property, birth, or other status. Furthermore, no distinction shall be made on the basis of the political, jurisdictional, or international status of the country or territory to which a person belongs, whether it be independent, trust, non-self-serving, or under any other limitation of sovereignty. Article 3. Everyone has the right to life, liberty, and security of person. Article 4. No one shall be held in slavery or servitude. Slavery and the slave trade shall be prohibited in all their forms. Article 5. No one shall be subjected to torture or to cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. Article 6. Everyone has the right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law. Article 7. All are equal before the law and are entitled without any discrimination to equal protection of the law. All are entitled to equal protection against any discrimination in violation of this declaration and against any incitement to such discrimination. Article 8. Everyone has the right to an effective remedy by the competent national tribunals for acts violating the fundamental rights granted him or her by the Constitution or by law. Article 9. No one shall be subjected to arbitrary arrest, detention, or exile. Article 10. Everyone is entitled, in full equality, to a fair and public hearing by an independent and impartial tribunal in the determination of his and her rights and obligations and of any criminal charge against him or her. Article 11. 1. Everyone charged with a penal offense has the right to be presumed innocent until proved guilty according to law in a public trial in which he or she has had all the guarantees necessary for his or her defense. 2. No one shall be held guilty of any personal offense on account of any act or omission which did not constitute a penal offense under national or international law at the time when it was committed, nor shall a heavier penalty be imposed than the one that was applicable at the time the penal offense was committed. Article 12. No one shall be subjected to arbitrary interference with his or her privacy, family, home, or correspondence, nor to attacks upon his or her honor and reputation. Everyone has the right to protection of the law against such interference or attacks. Article 12. 1. Everyone has the right to freedom of movement and residence within the borders of each state. 2. Everyone has the right to leave any country, including his or her own, and to return to his and her country, or her country. Article 14. 1. Everyone has the right to seek and to enjoy another country's asylum from persecution. 2. This right may not be invoked in the case of prosecutions genuinely arising from non-political crimes or from acts contrary to the purposes and principles of the United Nations. Article 15. 1. Everyone has a right to a nationality. 2. No one shall be arbitrarily deprived of his or her nationality, nor denied the right to change his or her nationality. Article 16. Men and women of full age without any limitation due to race, nationality, or religion have the right to marry and found a family. They are entitled to equal rights as to marriage during marriage at its dissolution. Marriage shall be entered into only with the free and full consent of the intending spouses. And the family is the natural and fundamental group unit of society and is entitled to protection by society and the state. Article 17. 1. Everyone has a right to own property alone as well as in association with others. 2. No one shall be arbitrarily deprived of his or her property. Article 18. Everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. This right includes freedom to change his or her religion or belief in freedom, either alone or in community with others and in public and private, to manifest his or her religion or belief in teaching, practice, worship, and observance. Article 19. Everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media and regardless of frontiers. Article 20. 1. Everyone has the right to freedom of peaceful assembly and association. 2. No one may be compelled to belong to an association. Article 21. 1. Everyone has the right to take part in the government of his or her country, directly or through freely chosen representatives. 2. Everyone has the right of equal access to public service in his or her country. 3. The will of the people shall be the basis of the authority of government. This will shall be expressed in periodic and genuine elections, which shall be by universal and equal suffrage, and shall be held by secret vote or by equivalent free voting procedures. Article 22. Everyone, as a member of society, has the right to social security and is entitled to realization through national effort and international cooperation and in accordance with the organization and resources of each state of the economic, social, and cultural rights indispensable for his or her dignity and the free development of his or her personality. Article 23. 1. Everyone has a right to work, to free choice of employment, to just and favorable conditions of work, and to protection against unemployment. 2. Everyone, without any discrimination, has the right to equal pay for equal work. 3. Everyone who works has the right to just and favorable remuneration, ensuring for him or herself and his or her family an existence worthy of human dignity and supplemented, if necessary, by other means of social protection. 4. Everyone has the right to form and join trade unions for the protection of his or her interest. Article 24. Everyone has the right to rest and leisure, including reasonable limitation of working hours and periodic holidays with pay. Article 25. 1. Everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of him or herself and of his or her family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care and necessary social services, and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, or other lack of livelihood in circumstances beyond his or her control. 2. Motherhood and childhood are entitled to special care and assistance. All children, whether born in or out of wedlock, shall enjoy the same social protection. Article 26. 1. Everyone has the right to education. Education shall be free, at least in the elementary and fundamental stages. Elementary education shall be compulsory. Technical and professional education shall be equally accessible to all on the basis of merit. 2. Education shall be directed to the full development of the human personality and to the strengthening of respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms. It shall promote understanding, tolerance, and friendship among all nations, racial or religious groups, and shall further the activities of the United Nations for the maintenance of peace. 3. Parents have a prior right to choose the kind of education that shall be given to their children. Article 27. 1. Everyone has a right to freely to participate in the cultural life of the community, to enjoy the arts and to share in scientific advancement and its benefits. 2. Everyone has the right to the protection of the moral and material interests resulting from any scientific, literary, or artistic production of which he or she is the author. Article 28. Everyone is entitled to a social and international order in which the rights and freedoms set forth in this declaration can be fully realized. Article 29. 1. Everyone has duties to the community in which alone the free and full development of his or her personality is possible. 2. In the exercise of his or her rights and freedoms, everyone shall be subject only to such limitations as are determined by law solely for the purpose of securing due recognition and respects for the rights and freedoms of others and of meeting the just requirements of morality, public order, and the general welfare of a democratic society. 3. These rights and freedoms may in no case be exercised contrary to the purposes and principles of the United Nations. And Article 30. Nothing in this declaration may be interpreted as implying for any state, group, or person any right to engage in any activity or to perform any act aimed at the destruction of any of the rights and freedoms set forth herein. And my rapid reading without the preamble and preface. This was the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which last Saturday celebrated its 63rd anniversary, December 10th, 2011. And the committee that developed was spearheaded by Eleanor Roosevelt in 1948. And this has been Michael McCusker. I won't be here live next week or the following week. I will be back the first week of the new year. So a couple of what you might call archival programs that I recorded previously in the last couple of years will be played instead of my live self. Indeed, we can replicate and duplicate ourselves forever, almost each instant of the day in this modern miracle of technology we live under these days. Of course, everyone can listen and see and spy upon us forever also in this modern miracle world that we have devised for ourselves. So Merry Christmas. And Happy New Year.